And we understand that this one can be directly linked into that one if we have particular definitions for the evolution of the lapse and the shift, right? So we wrote, let me just write them again, what the conditions box of x be equal to some source functions h's determined for the lapse and the shift. We have an evolution. Let me just write one of them. Right, so specifying this, we obtain this equation for the lapse. So if we come back in here, we could specify exactly the same conditions for the lapse and the shift. So there is a one-to-one correspondence. Furthermore, here, the evolution equations that we get were of the form, let me just write it this way, second time derivatives of the metric GAB equal a bunch of things. In this camp, this way, we have evolutions for the metric gamma ij. Let me just think of the ADM for simplicity, the ADM, comma t, gamma ij and kij, comma t equal a bunch of things. So suppose we have worked hard to come up with the best possible system of equations. We also have, if we understood how to do it, or if we had a good feeling of how to modify the equations by adding zeros to drive things, the constraints to zero, this is something we did, we could do easily here. Here it's not as clear because of the split. But in practice, for black holes, space-time, they seem to be doing the job when one monitors the constraints, and this is something we'll talk in a few minutes. One sees that the constraints are well behaved for those cases. So intrinsically, having us use, remember, in this formulation in the BSSN, we explicitly make use of the constraints to replace some variables. In doing so, we're in some ways controlling the constraints, at least a subset of those. But now the question is, okay, so you have everything done. Now you want to study a particular physical situation. How do you do that? We have never mentioned anything about initial data. And here on this side, we also have to worry about boundary data. But we have discussed a little bit here, and I'll say some more things about the boundary data later, but let me just comment a few things about initial data. For simplicity, I'll do it from the point of view of the ADM formulation. Because there we had a simple set of equations that we understood well, its geometrical meaning, which is lost in this picture when we're doing everything with respect to the full four-dimensional metric. And in the BSSN, it's also lost in some sense when we start pulling things out of the variables. They are not, we cannot say, oh, this particular variable, as we do in this case, is intrinsic geometry. This is intrinsic curvature at that hypersurface. This is the extrinsic curvature, how that hypersurface is embedded in the full, in the one extra dimensional spacetime that this hypersurface belongs to. So this is not as clear, even though there is a simple correspondence. This is the one that has the most clean geometrical meaning. So there, let me recall, we have two constraints. The Hamiltonian and the momentum constraints. Let me just write them down here. So you have the Hamiltonian constraint. Which is the Ricci scalar of the three-dimensional hypersurface plus the extrinsic curvature, the trace of the extrinsic curvature square minus the product of the extrinsic curvature equal to zero, or actually to rho, where rho is the density of the matter or the energy contribution of the stress energy tensor. So let me just define this here. So we define rho to be TAB in A and B, SI to be minus gamma I alpha A and B TAB, and SIJ gamma I A gamma I gamma J B TAB. So with these definitions, this is the local energy density that an observer moving along the normal to the hypersurface will measure. This is, in a sense, the selective momenta that that observer will measure, and this is the rest of the information that is contained in the stress energy tensor. So the Hamiltonian constraint is equal to this. In the absence of the source, of course, we have a zero there, and the 8 pi we have absorbed. We take a pi equal to 1 if you want. Otherwise, we can just absorb the 8 pi in the definition of the TAB. And we have the momentum constraint, which is given by the derivative on the special. This is the covariant derivative of gamma ij associated to gamma ij, acting on not equal to zero. This is in vacuum, equal to SI. We argued, we proved it implicitly here when we saw that the constraints would be preserved through the future of a given hypersurface, that if we give consistent initial data, the constraints will remain satisfied towards the future. But now the question is, how do we give consistent initial data? Any initial data that we'll give, again, which would be the pair gamma ij kij, has to satisfy these equations. So we have this issue where we have to give 12, a correct set of initial data corresponds to 12 pieces of information. But we have only four equations. So we have a lot more freedom than the number of, or the amount of information we have to give. We have to provide the full gamma ij, the full kij, but we only have four equations, four guiding principles to satisfy. This is very similar to the equations in electromagnetism. Again, we have said some of these things as we went along, but let me just concentrate on this here, where, say, in the absence of sources, these are the equations we had to obey to provide consistent initial data for Maxwell's equations. These are two equations, but we have a total of six unknowns. So now we have to decide how we're going to give that consistent data. Well, one alternative, the simplest alternative, is to say, okay, I'll give E1, E2, B1, and B2, and I will solve for E3 and B3 from this equation, right? But what's special, if we choose to do so, which will be fine, we'll still be given something that is perfectly consistent with the data. Somehow one could argue, well, what's special about the one and two components for both E and B, and why are we only solving for E3 and B3? You could come and do a rotation of your axis and understand what you chose, what you call E1 before, now happens to be E3. So there's amazing how they break in so many pieces. There is nothing special about E3, obviously, because you can always rotate your frame. So then this is kind of delicate, even though at the end of the day you do have something perfectly consistent. So you like to do something that is better. One particular thing that you did do, or you, did, you, might ha- you must have seen before, in electrostatic, for instance, was to say, well, if I need to satisfy this equation, and a way to do so is to say, well, let me define, or let me assume, that E comes from the gradient of some undetermined function. Once you plug this in here, what you end up with is Laplacian of phi equals 0, say. And now you have a single equation for a single unknown, which is phi. Once you determine phi, you take the gradient, and now you have E. And at this level, you have treated all components in exactly kind of an equal footing. And if you do want to recover the solution, you can still do it. By judiciously chosen phi, you can always have the gradient give you precisely what you wanted for E1 and E2, and then obtain E3 from that equation. So this is more generic in that sense. And at the end of the day, it gives you something clean, and it buys you two things. The first thing is to give something that is democratic in a sense. That's not a big deal. It's just a matter of taste where you want to be democratic or not. But the second is you end up with a resulting equation, which is elliptic. That is that equation, Laplacian of phi equal to 0. And we can discuss, if you want, in more details afterwards. This will take more formal concepts. That these equations are always really good, both mathematically and numerically. Solving them is very easy. When it's guaranteed that if you have the correct boundary conditions, you're going to get a solution, that solution is going to be well behaved. You might have to wait a bit long to get the solution, but it's going to be fine. So you always end up looking for something like this in your solving elliptic problem, just as we always ended up looking for something like that in the hyperbolic problem. I notice that this and that are very intimately connected. So if I went to our second derivative of time in here with a minus sign, right, we go to this one. And in fact, if we start with the Hamiltonian constraint and we take the appropriate limits by saying time derivatives are much more slowly varying than spatial derivatives, we end up getting out of this equation Poisson's equations that determine the gravitational potential of a given source. And it's always, these equations are always found, in some sense, the elliptic equations are always, in a way, understood as just a limiting procedure of a hyperbolic equation where the time variations are much, much lower than the gradient variations. Anyway, so we like to copy that from there. So I'm not going to describe the general, how to solve these equations in general. I'll just tell you the main ingredients. Because at the end of the day, you never, given that you don't know the solution, the best you can do is solve for the initial data that you want in an approximate manner. And I'll tell you why in a second as we discuss. But let me just for simplicity think of the following problem. Let's imagine that we want to recover Schwarzschild. So we have then stationarity or staticity as a condition. So there is no time variation. So we're imagining that our slices, once we pick a slice, it will just be copied off forward to the future, which then tells us the extrinsic curvature has to be 0. We can even take this in more general situations, but let's for a moment just think of Schwarzschild. So that is what we're assuming, which means that immediately the second set of constraints, a momentum constraint that contains three equations in total, will be satisfied. So we'll put a check mark here. And simply by assuming this, we have that solved. Furthermore, by assuming this one, by now looking into this one and that, our assumption, these two pieces will be gone. And so the Hamiltonian constraint, let me just denote that by HC, implies that right, just that the Ricci is equal to 0, of the three metrics, of course. Right? So remember we had to give gamma ij and kij, we're given this with 0. We now have to obtain gamma ij. And now we face a problem similar to this one, where I have to give 6 bits of information, but you have only one equation. How in the world am I going to pick one particular one with respect to the other one? So I can say, well, I'm going to solve for gamma xx, and I'm going to give everything else by hand. That's one option. But we could argue exactly the same way. That's not a very democratic choice. There is another simpler way, which is to say, imagine or assume that gamma ij is equal to phi square. So this is similar to the phi that I use here. Some field. And I put the square here just because it will make the algebra simpler, equal to eta ij, where eta ij is the flat metric. So this, what we're saying is that the solution is conformally flat. Once you've used this ansatz now, here, I'm giving all the piece of information. I'm saying that the only thing we're determining, that we're solving for, is essentially the determinant of the resulting metric. Everything else is just the flat metric. Once you plug this in here, and this, we again can use what I mentioned yesterday. If we go, say, in particular to the appendix of Wald, there is a bunch of expressions that say, given a metric that is related to another metric by this conformal factor, you can relate all the operators that you want, in particular the Ricci scalar or the Ricci tensor, to the Ricci tensor of that one, and the only thing you pick up are derivatives of this guy. And given that the Ricci tensor of this one, we're talking about the flat metric, then this is a very trivial thing to know. So if we have zero with the right assumptions, then the only thing you have is just not flushing related to this one. So when you plug this in here, what you end up with is something that looks like this. Equal zero, or if you have a source, you might have equal rho, right, equal two rho. So now we went back to, now we have a single equation to solve for, and more importantly, we end up with an elliptic problem. So again, this is another problem we can solve with a bunch of techniques. And I'll tell you in just a few minutes. So in particular, this is what I said, that you never, for a more generic situation that you may be thinking about, you will only be able to get what you want in an approximate manner, even at the analytical level. And I'll tell you, I'll give you this example. Let me first discuss Schwarzschild. So suppose we want to recover Schwarzschild. So far out, we're always going to say the phi goes to 1. Right? Because if phi goes to 1, we'll recover flat space time. Of course, this would be a way to solve the problem in asymptotic flat space time. If you were doing ADS, where you have a time-like boundary at a finite distance, then that might not be the appropriate boundary condition you want to pose. But let me just concentrate on the asymptotically flat case. You also know that Schwarzschild has a hole, or has an event horizon. It's not a hole, but has a particular surface. So you can say, well, at that particular surface, chosen by arbitrarily by you, you can give the value of phi, or the value of the gradient of phi, in this. And by determining, by placing a particular value there, what you'll be determining is the size of your black hole. As a result, then, I mean, if you solve this problem, what you'll find is that this phi is the appropriate value for Schwarzschild written in isotropic coordinates. When you write Schwarzschild in isotropic coordinates, the three part of the metric is precisely given by this. There is a conformal factor times just a flat metric. And there you get precisely the solution you're trying to get. But let me just give you this next simple example. Suppose you try to get the Kerr solution. And you adopt exactly the same ansatz. You say, okay, Kij is equal to zero. And this is fine. We know that Kerr is stationary, so this assumption that the next surface is stacked in time are exactly equal to the previous ones, that tells us that Kij is equal to zero. But this assumption that assumption, and exactly going through the same thing, you give a particular value 45 here, and you go asymptotically far, does not give you curve. It gives you curve plus something else. It gives you a perturbed, if you want a perturbed curve. And this is a theorem that was solved or proved about 15 years ago, that with this assumption, you cannot recover the curve solution. What you recover is a black hole that has some angular momentum, but there is some certain amount of radiation outside that compensates. So the idea is that the curve solution is not conformally flat. Therefore, if you're forcing conformally flatness in the solution of your problem, what must happen is that you have a black hole that has some angular momentum, and sparse or around the black hole, in a way that decays away as you go to farther and farther distances, there is garbage radiation or some extra radiation content in your space that exactly counteracts the contribution of the isolated curved black hole we have to prevent the fact that the metric is conformal. So curve is not conformally flat. If you're forcing that, then there is some extra content of energy in the form of gravitational waves, because we're solving the Ricci or the Hamiltonian equal to zero, which accounts for precisely the rest of, for what you need in order to make things conformally flat. There's exactly the same thing will happen in Maxwell's equations. If you're trying to solve this problem for a particular distribution, so if you imagine that you're trying to solve a distribution of, say, two charges that are just standing still, and they have two different values, so positive and negative. You know that the charges cannot be standing still. They will, if you just let them at rest, they will come together and merge and collide with each other just because there is an attractive force. But if by definition you're assuming kind of stationarity of the charges, so something has to be there preventing the charges from attracting each other, which will then be, okay, there is some electromagnetic radiation in the problem that is providing the exact amount of repulsion in the problem so that these charges are momentaneously at a time, at a stationarity configuration, right? And if we knew precisely what you wanted to give, then you would know the solution of the problem, and we wouldn't be doing this. So what you, the name or the way we deal with this problem is to say, you try to get the closest possible solution to the physical situation you have in mind. You know that you're going to have to live with some amount of garbage content in your initial data, but hopefully, and in practice it happens, the dynamics will eventually clean itself up, just as you do with the example we just mentioned, a positive or negative charge in electromagnetism. They say at a moment of time they are stationary. Okay, you have some radiation there, but you know the radiation propagates at the speed of light. At some point, this radiation just will leave the region in between the charges, and the charges will indeed begin to attract each other. So in practice, what you do is you evolve for a while, and you don't consider the initial stage to be a physically valid stage. You think of it as a transient, and then eventually the true solution is the one that dominates the problem. And that's the reason, remember, when I showed you the movies on Monday, of these black holes going around each other that generate radiation, and I say, okay, all this that you saw at the early part is crap. Well, it's because what you're seeing is essentially is the energy that is coming out of the system in the form of gravitational waves by the fact that you're using some assumptions. In particular, in order to simplify the initial value problem for two black holes going around each other, something that you put by hand, and I'll tell you why in a second, is that these two black holes are going in a circular trajectory. But you know that's impossible. That's exactly the same thing as the two charges, imagining that they will be standing still. Two objects in general relativity cannot have circular orbit because gravitational waves will be robbing angular momentum from the system. And the true solution is there is a slight radial velocity of these two black holes getting together. But because you don't know what it is, you impose circular trajectories, which also simplify the problem of what to do with this guy. I'll tell you again in a second. And then you get a solution, and you assume, or you know that the first stages of revolution have a contamination due to this incorrect, non-kosher initial data that you're providing. So where does this thing come from? If you're trying to solve this for these two black holes, you can still solve for two black holes with this under that assumption. You can always imagine that your problem, you're taking a snapshot of your problem, you're choosing your initial hypersurface at a moment of time symmetry, which doesn't mean that forever the Kazuinski curvature will be zero, but you say, at that moment, I'm going to assume that there is a moment of time symmetry, and you can get rid of this one. And then you can play by assuming that you have two regions where you're going to give this value of phi and solve for the resulting metric, and that gives you two black holes. Unfortunately, you don't have you like to have more freedom because you like to say, okay, this black hole is moving in this direction, that black hole is moving in that direction, which corresponds, say, to a Keplerian trajectory of black holes going around each other. So you actually like to be able to get some more piece of information you can play with. So you like to, then in practice what you do is you actually work with these two equations. We just discussed how you would get an equation, an elliptic equation, here by using this assumption. This one is a priori nothing related to an elliptic equation. Like what I have is the first derivative of my extrinsic curvature. I don't see how I'm going to get a Laplacian out of it. So in practice, what you say, and this I'm going to be very schematically described in many references. I just want to give you the gist of what's in there. You say, well, now I have another equation. Remember what I did. In this equation, I said I'm going to solve, I have only one equation. I'm going to solve for the scalar field or the conformal factor, and everything else is given. Here I have three more equations, but I want to fix Kij. Kij has six pieces of information, so I have to give three by hand, and I have to solve for the other three. So what you say is that the Kij can be written in terms of some, let me just call it little Kij, which you give by hand by some certain assumptions, plus, so this is known, plus some, and let me write it this way, di of wj symmetrized, because kij is symmetric. So you're saying, what you're doing is translating the unknown that is hidden here, the set of unknowns hidden here, by writing it equal to some piece that is known that you're going to give by hand. It could even be zero. And the other piece is saying, okay, it's a derivative of another field that I'm not going to, that I don't know. This is the most closest, this is the closest analogous to what we did here by saying that the E was going to be the gradient of some field, and that's how we ended up with a Laplacian, with an elliptic operator. Once you plug this in here, you know that you see that you have a derivative of this omega, or this W field, and then as a result, you end up with an equation on the momentum constraint that says Laplacian of omega j equal to a bunch of things. So then the Hamiltonian constraint, you have Laplacian of omega j, Laplacian phi, equal to a bunch of things that in the, that couples the two of them. And again, the question or the problem is on us to define appropriate boundary conditions for this omega j. You can imagine that if you go very, very far from the source, regardless of what the source is doing, this guy should go to zero. There should be no, this essentially is tied to the rotation of this object. And close, well, then you can use the boundary conditions on omega to specify precisely what you want this black hole to do, or anything. Let me just mention in passing that this assumption, gamma ij equal to phi square eta ij, is not a priori, does not have to be like that. I mean, you can choose any known metric here. So if we want to solve this problem that we mentioned, that we couldn't recover Kerr this way, because Kerr is not asymptotically, it's not conformally flat, we can change this metric and put something else, which says Kerr, and then you obviously can get Kerr back from it by using the appropriate metric here. The key point is you have to use the appropriate background solution. If you're trying to do this in cosmology, for instance, and you're trying to solve for initial data that describes perturbations in cosmology, well, it might be best to put here the Friedman-Robertson-Walker solution and build the perturbations on phi. Otherwise, phi will contain, if you put flat metric and you're talking about an expanding universe, this phi will contain two pieces, the perturbation plus the fact that the metric you're putting here does not correspond to the background that you're trying to solve for. So it's easier to just then use, instead of eta ij, just put the Freeman-Robinson-Walker solution for the corresponding spacetime, for the corresponding physical situation, and then just let phi keep the perturbation. Right? So don't, this is just one particular ancestor you can use. You can all take advantage of freedom. Okay, so let me just say one more thing. And this is kind of the, as I said, these equations are the easiest to iterate. You can always get a good solution out of it. It might be very expensive, but you can always get a good solution. And that has to do with the following. Let me go a little bit on the numerical techniques again. And we're going to use a little bit of what we know. Suppose we're dealing, instead of with a hyperbolic equation, let me imagine that we're dealing with this equation. The time derivatives of some field, let me call it pi, for the time being, is equal to the Laplacian, with a factor here, is equal to the Laplacian of phi. So let me do the Fourier expansion of this. We do Fourier analysis. And imagine that phi, just as we've done like 3 weeks ago, will have some dependence on time like this, times, and each mode, this is a linear equation, so each mode I'll represent as e to the ikx, and let me, for simplicity, think that we're in one dimension, so we just have that equation. Okay, so when I plug this in this equation, what we have is dt of e to the st, e to the ikx, let me just write like this, equal to now k of k, kappa. And this should be k. So let me just put a twiddle here so that we distinguish that constant value from the Fourier mode, from the wave number here. So it's going to be kappa. From here, when I take the second derivative, what I get is k square e to the st e to the I kappa x. Right? When the time derivative only acts on this one, which will bring an s, and everything else can be simplified. So then this implies that s is equal to kappa twiddle times minus k square, which means that the solution is e to the minus kappa k square t e to the ikx. So if we imagine that we have chosen kappa twiddle positive, what we have is an exponentially decaying function whose higher wave numbers die away a lot faster than the low frequency numbers, right? And asymptotically, if I ask the question, what is the time variation of this guy? It goes to zero, right? Because it's a rapidly exponentially decaying function. And furthermore, just if I look at this in here, notice that this equation, when will this equation stop changing or will stop having a source of time variation? It will stop changing when the Laplacian of phi is equal to zero. Right? So once the Laplacian of phi is equal to zero, that solution doesn't change anymore. We stay there. And so that is the basic strategy for solving this equation. What you do is you're trying to solve an equation, phi of x, that satisfies, say, Laplacian of phi equals something. So this is what you're trying to solve. You imagine that you promote this function that only knew about space coordinates to a function that depends on space, the space coordinates plus an extra parameter, which if you want, you can think of it in terms of time, but it's actually a parameter that labels the sequence of phis that you're getting to achieve the final solution. So from here, you promote phi to a phi of, say, lambda x. And when lambda goes to infinity, the solution you get is the solution you want, which is the solution that satisfies Laplacian of phi equal that. So what you do is precisely to say, well, let me just imagine that the equation is this one so that we have a source. So what you say is you look for this one, Laplacian of phi minus the source is equal to the derivative with respect to lambda of phi. So what we do is you turn the elliptic equation into an equation that is parabolic. And you just solve for it numerically. With exactly the same techniques we've been dealing with, you can just do that and do an evaluation in time. There's one caveat, and that's why I said these equations, when you solve them this way, they may be more expensive. And the reason is, remember, so if I imagine that lambda is our time, we would have to pick a delta lambda or a d lambda, which is pictorially how we picture the sequence of time slices of lambda slicings in our evolution, to stably treat this equation, which at the analytical level, by the way, again, let me stress it, we'll just have a decaying exponential. We couldn't ask for anything better because there is no instability associated with this problem. The power in each mode decays away as we go on in time. Even with that, with that property, which analytically would be the best possible one, we still have a criteria for this delta lambda. We couldn't choose them arbitrarily large. In fact, the criteria for stability is a lot more stricter than the one that we found for the hyperbolic problems. Remember, in the hyperbolic problem, we would have said this is the relationship that the time spacing or the lambda spacing is proportional to the points spacing in space. That's for a hyperbolic. For a parabolic, this goes like delta squared. And very loosely speaking, if I look at this equation, notice I have a 1 over x squared in the denominator in here, just because I have a derivative, the second order derivative. And here I have a 1 over lambda, which means now in dimensional arguments, the lambda has to scale like x squared. And this is what is showing up in here. And that's the reason why I say it's more expensive, because now for a small enough, spacing, this number is much more than that one. So it could be rather onerous as far as the computation is concerned. Of course, if you're doing things in one dimension, this is not a big deal. If you're doing things in higher dimensions, then or two or three dimensions, this could be a major, it could involve major time. But it's good time. It's not time that that at the end of the day you're going to get the solution that has gone to hell. You're going to get the right solution. You might have to wait longer. So as a result, there are tons of techniques that improve upon this. The guts, this the spirit that you're doing, but they then begin to make use explicitly of the fact that you know that higher frequency modes will die so fast that you don't have to worry about them in the same way as the low frequency mode. So there is the most famous technique is this one. It's called multigrid, which is a way to say the following. The high frequency modes will die off very, very quickly. The low frequency modes, the ones that have this very long wavelength, are the ones that will subsist and that typically will determine the solution. The good thing about that is if you have a very long wavelength, so if you have something that has kind of that shape, you don't need a whole lot of points. It's just, one point here, another point there, another point there, another point there. That's a pretty good representation of that very long wavelength behavior. And the solution will have, say, long wavelength and short wavelength. The short wavelength, do need a lot of resolution, but those are the ones that will converge and die away the fastest. So this multigrid, that's the reason why it's multigrid, says, okay, if this is your computational domain, you set up a sequence of different grids, and in these different grids, one more resolved than the other one, you solve for the low frequency, high frequency, and you go back and forth correcting the low and high frequencies in a kind of a complicated algorithm, but what the algorithm is doing is exploiting heavily this observation. But as I said, if you're going to start solving an elliptic equation for the first time, this is the easiest way to do. And then as you get kind of disappointed by how long you have to wait for getting the solution, you may be looking into other options. OK, so that was what I wanted to say. So suppose you work in doing whatever technique you have chosen for whatever problem. You have solved your initial value problem. You have solved your evolution. Now you begin to think, what is it that I have to worry about in trying to get the physics out of the solution? So let me just say, mention a few things that you should be looking into. If you're not doing general relativity, everything we've said is still valid, but the quantities you'll be looking for are different, of course. So the obvious thing if you're doing numerical relativity nowadays is essentially mainly dominated by the search of gravitational waves. And so obtaining the gravitational waves is kind of the crucial quantity. So let me just say a few things about that. So how do you get the gravitational waves out of your problem? The good thing is that you're evolving the system, so you have full control of the solution as you go forward in time. And so now what we are going to discuss is just some basic criteria, some basic quantities you should calculate in order to get the right information out. Obtaining gravitational waves rigorously is extremely delicate. Why? Because you can only make sense of even the definition of what a gravitational wave is rigorously if you go infinitely far. And this is something you probably haven't been told in much detail because people usually ignore that. But the problem is, what is it that you're trying to do? So a gravitational wave will have, say, a circle, a ring of particles. As the gravitational wave passes, it will deform it in this way, then deforms, goes back to circle, then deforms in that way, goes back to a circle, and the whole process continues, and it has two polarizations. But you know that you could come and do a Courier transformation and have a perfect circle, and do, even in Schwarzschild, you can do the Courier transformation and make that happen just through a Courier transformation. You just make your coordinates do this and that. So if I do the Courier transformation, x goes to x plus a sine omega t, and same thing with y, okay, I see precisely that. How do I disentangle this, which is a purely coordinate effect, to the real true effect that you're trying to measure? That's why, in order to make this very rigorously, you have to make sure you go infinitely far so that you don't have any curvature effect that you also, you want to get this and you want to get the amplitude. And the amplitude will, if you're measuring things very close to the strong gravity regime, also might be affected by the fact that you have a strong curvature. You actually want to make sure that you can tell if I have these two say lines and no gravitational wave passes, that they just stay parallel to each other, never changing their distances. If you're very close to horizon, so very close to, say, a Schwarzschild black hole, and you leave these two things, you know that you're going to come together, they're going to fall into the black hole, and they're going to get closer and closer. Would you call that a wave? Of course not. But because you're so too close to the strongly curved region, you cannot tell the difference. So A, you have to go very far out. B, you have to be very, very careful with the coordinates that you're using. And C, you now have to make sure also that there is this gauge ambiguity in the field variables that you also have to make sure you clean out. So there is a beautiful geometrical structure to do so. This was introduced by Penrose in the 60s. It's called you go all the way to null infinity. If you go to infinity, if you basically get on a null ray, go as far as you can prove rigorously that if you go to infinity, the metric will be exactly flat. And then the only thing that can get there are gravitational waves because they propagate at the speed of light. And by measuring how the vicinity of this surface that you add on by hand how that varies, then you know you can calculate explicitly what the gravitational waves are, having, of course, taken enough effort to make sure that there are no coordinate effects. Unfortunately, for most applications, there is a way to do precisely what Newman suggested, but it's not typically in numerical simulations. It involves a lot more work. Unfortunately, in numerics, you face two problems. Typically, you don't go to infinity. Typically, your coordinates are not chosen by you to simplify your job at getting the gravitational waves. You have exploited the freedom in your coordinates to simplify your life in dealing with these black holes that are going around, or dealing with the issues that we discussed about the formulation of the equations themselves. So you have to live with what the simulation is giving you as far as the coordinate conditions. So now you have to dig that information out in an explicit manner. On the other hand, there are a few tests that you can make to make sure that you're getting the right quantity. I'll mention some of those. So having gone a long time, so basically what we assume is that you have, say, the metric and the extrinsic curvature, the lapse and the shift, and now you want to get the gravitational waves out. Something you can do, and this is again analytically, you can prove that the gravitational wave content is encoded in the Biot tensor. Furthermore, you can prove that the Biot tensor, certain components of the Biot tensor for an asymptotically flat spacetime behave in a very particular way. By that I mean the following. Suppose you introduce four null vectors, essentially like this. You choose a null vector that goes away from your sources towards infinity, which is an arrow vector going in to the sources along the null direction. And then you choose two more orthogonal to them. And you can prove rigorously that you couldn't find four real null vectors. You have to get two of those, have to be complex. So these vectors are, let me just call it L, N, M, and M bar. And for simplicity, let me just tell you what these vectors would be in flat spacetime. So if you were in flat spacetime, L would be d dt and spherical coordinates plus d dr. N is the same with a minus sign. M says d d theta plus I d d phi. And M bar is a complex conjugate of that, so it has a minus sign. So in flat spacetime, you can prove that the following conditions are satisfied. And I have to put a 1 over the square root of 2 everywhere. And everything else is 0. OK, so now there is this interesting result that says the following. Suppose you construct the following combination of your Biot tensor. That's something called psi zero. This is out of the Newman-Penrose formalism. There is a phi 1, which is now C, A, B, C, D. And now you have N, A, L, beta, N, gamma, M, delta, or M, D. And let me just go. There is an analysis of phi 2, psi 3, psi 4. There is a write-up in the last project of the course, which I don't think you're going to get to. So I'll just we're going to skip that. But the expressions are given. Let me just get to the punchline. before we run out of time. So it's the same thing. Okay, so what you are doing here is just contracting the bile tensor with this tetrad that you introduce. And by doing so, you're just picking combination along different directions. And the curious result is you can prove a bunch of things out of this, is that psi I, or I going from 1, from 0, well, let me just call it psi p, into 4, will behave for a source that is compact, so that is localized, a localized source in a given portion of the spacetime. If you go far out in a radial direction, will behave as order 1 over r to the minus 5 plus p. That is, this guy decays like 1 over r to the fifth. This guy, psi 4, decays like 1 over r. This is called the peeling property of the spacetime, which is an assumption. It was proved by Helmut Friedrich in the 80s under some assumptions, but in general we really don't have a general theorem that says this is going to be true. But this is consistent. This behavior is consistent with this construction by Penrose of the flats null infinity. Okay, but the most important guy is this guy, in some sense, psi 4. Psi 4 can be seen that it's to be related to the plus, or at far distance is given by this. Where these are the strains of the plus polarization of the gravitational wave and the cross-polarization of the gravitational wave. How are these defined? Well, these are defined in the following way. H plus is 1/2. And I have to put something here without defining. I'll tell you what it is. So this is, if you go infinitely far along the radial direction, and you write, you see what your metric is, your metric will be given by, and your coordinates are good enough, and you have chosen the right coordinates, that's what I mean, your metric, your full metric will behave like the flat metric, plus some perturbation, and if you pick the right gauge and the right combination, this is the transverse traceless part of the perturbation. So you can see that this, so some, if you write the Einstein's equations there, you find out that this component obeys a wave equation. In this sense, we understand also that the perturbation is propagated at the speed of light. These guys are related to the plus and cross polarization in this way, and these guys are related to the psi 4 in this way. And something you can prove is that if m is the mass of your spacetime as measured by an asymptotic observer, the time derivative of that is related to the integral of this guy. So it's 1 over 4 pi. The integral at r going on the surface at r going to infinity of the integral between 0 and time of psi 4 dt square r squared d omega. Remember, the fact that psi 4 goes at 1 over r, psi 4 squared goes at 1 over r squared, simplifies at r squared. So this is the flux of energy that gravitational waves are carrying out from you. And there is an analogous formula that also involves psi 4 to compute what is the angular momentum carried away by gravitational waves. So again, this is tricky. You have to make sure that you construct these vectors. Yes?
So how long did it take to get the formula for flux of energy carried by gravitational waves?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. See, this observation, in fact, Einstein's first paper, Einstein-Rosen paper, on gravitational waves was written, the initial title was something like On the Non-Existence of Gravitational Waves. So they didn't believe it. Einstein never liked referees, but the referees saved that work. It's now well understood that, so he goes to the referee says, no, you're misunderstanding your own theory. And there was a back and forth, Einstein got very annoyed at this. But in, and this was, this surfaced not too long ago, in the proofs, the paper got changed from on the non-existent to the on the existent of gravitational waves, pretty much. And it had to do with this one. You say, well, if I have a gauge, I can move around things, and I can see, I mean, these the kind of arguments that we put around, that we can, just a Courant transformation, if I know that a Courant transformation can fake this, then you can say, well, if that's real, or if you think it's real, I can always come out and do a Courant transformation that will undo this behavior. And so there was a lot of back and forth till essentially this proof was put forward, where you can say, okay, you, there is a well-defined notion of the mass, a well-defined notion of the time variation of the mass, and then you find out, oh, I should have put a minus sign there, that the mass will decrease due to this psi 4. This is still not complete, and this because you can say, well, okay, this tells me that the mass decays. So if I start with some mass versus time, this one goes like that. Okay, but suppose this one goes like that and goes in that direction, then we're bad, right? Because we have crossed and there is no sense in which the mass should be negative. And so this issue also lingered around for a long time, and it was Witten, the one that proved the positivity of mass theorem. This is, okay, this cannot happen. What will happen is that, and essentially goes asymptotically to zero if you're going to radiate everything. And even Witten's proof is incomplete. In that proof, there was one equation that said, okay, let's assume, I don't know if these equations have a solution, but let's, it seemed that they would have a solution. It was in 1982, a professor, a student in Chicago finally completed the proof by showing that that equation did have a nice, the nice solutions that you were hoping for. Yeah, so as I said, this is a controversy that started in the 50s, and in a way only got fully closed in 82. But now we go, so here notice that this says, okay, you have to go very far out, you have to be in the right corners, you have to do this integral to infinity. That's not what you have in your computation. Your computation is, you have a finite computational domain, you're not very close to infinity, so how do you have confidence that what you're getting is the right thing, given that all these issues could come in and play a role? Unfortunately for us, well, we have full control of the spacetime. So you could say, well, I don't have any surface at infinity, but I can have a surface here, another surface there, another surface there. I can compute exactly the same quantity, exactly the same, the psi 4, at three different or n different locations. And then you expect that if it is a true gravitational wave, it will first be registered here, then there, and it will have, and if I shift in time, what I measure here, here, and there, they should all coincide. So you and that's indeed what happens. So if you get the simulations, you find out that if you are too close, you're getting something that doesn't really make sense. But as you get further surfaces further and further out, you do the right shifting in time by knowing that this one, say, was at 100 m's from, say, 100 kilometers, this was at 200 kilometers, you know how much time there should be for offset. You offset by that, and you look at one on top of the other one, you get the right result. So you could do further tests, given that you know that you're not doing everything kosher, to make sure that what you're communicating is the right physical behavior. So that's one thing. So again, if you look at it nowadays, people, because again, the psis are obtained from the Biot, the Biot are obtained from the Riemann. The Riemann, you calculate from the metric, and you have the metric. So that's something you can always calculate. The other thing is you also want to know, here there is a boundary. That the boundaries are not playing a role. We discussed this in terms of the boundary conditions, that if we know the characteristics, we know for sure there is some certain amount of time where these guys are certainly not influenced things in here. But you want to evolve for longer than that, and so you sometimes you're saying, okay, what is the solution there? And again, this same trick can help you out. If you see a feature that first is registered here, then registered there, and then registered there, then you know that's coming from the outside in. You can clean that out, and you can say from here on, this is what I'm doing to clean my data, so take it with a grain of salt, but the rest should be okay, or we hope. We give indications of why we think it's okay, but with warning signs. Let me just say. The other thing is that this has to do with a comment that James made a while ago. So now suppose you want to look at the metric itself. You want to understand what is the curvature doing. Okay, so we have a problem because here we have a bunch of variables. Which variable will tell you anything that is sensible? You know that, again, Korean transformation can change the information of these guys. So flat, Minkowski in flat coordinates does not look the same as spherical coordinates. And so what are you looking at? Well, you look for the most gauge invariant quantities you can think of, in particular curvatures, scalars. So again, out of the Riemann, for instance, there is an invariant, a well-known invariant called the Kretschmann invariant. And the good news about this is that, well, here you had to deal with a bunch of components. This is just one number, or one number per point. And this is something you can picture. You can see that the curvature is stronger here and goes to zero at infinity. So you could plot this guy. And if you're doing it for Schwarzschild, this goes like 48 n square over r to the 6. So you're going to see something like, it looks like that. And this is something that, well, how do you see this curvature? That would be one quantity. Also, if you are evolving, remembering the BSSN, one particular quantity you get is the determinant of gamma ij. Okay, so this one has, in some sense, a good information if you're assuming that you're sufficiently close to a conformally flat scenario. So these are just some examples of what one could do. But depending on your situation, you just have to think of what is the appropriate gauge invariant quantity, or as possibly, as much as invariant as you can for a given set of tests that you like to get. So before we end, let me just say a few more things to wrap things up. So let me go back to the first week for just 2 minutes. So in the first week, we discuss things about how to, say, iterate this equation. And we introduced two particular techniques or two particular options. One was to say, okay, I do this in by doing. And we discussed that that's a second order approximation to the derivative. Of course, that one may be accurate enough for you. You'd like to have more accuracy. But we gave a basic criteria using the standard approximation of how you could get something that is higher order. So if you need more orders, you know what the basic steps are to get something that will be more accurate than second order iteration. So that was for the derivative. For time iteration, we discussed two basic options. One where you consider this stencil, right? This was a leapfrog method or something where you say, now imagine that we're doing this equation. For that, we said, okay, you can do time this way, space that way, and iterate that way. That's one way. For the other one, we discussed is Krang-Nicholson, where you just take two levels. You don't have anything in the new level, and you just keep iterating. Right? So those were two. But what I want to stress is that those were just two very simple-minded options. There's tons of options out there. Particularly notable is something called it has a fancier name than what it actually is. It's method of lines, which says, suppose you know a good set of techniques to iterate ODEs. A standard one, very well known, is the Runge-Kutta method that you probably have heard before. This is if you have an ODE equation that says, D of f with respect to t equals some function of f, then you can imagine that you go from one level to the next one, and you tell me what order of accuracy you like to do in time. And there are these well-defined methods that I said, okay, you can go from here to there by assuming there are a series of intermediate steps where you keep using the equation, and you build up a scheme that is as accurate as you want. The method of lines for PDE is exactly the same one. It's to say, okay, if I have an equation, and let me just write, something like this, the derivative the partial derivative of u equal, partial derivative of u times f plus u square, etc., a bunch of terms. It says, think of putting a really hard line between this equal sign, the left side and the right side, and say, I want the left side to be completely blind to with respect to what you're going in the right-hand side. So you're going to come up with a series of discretization techniques or whatever you want to do to discretize this. Once you do that, what you have is an operator. Let me just call it now, for obvious reasons, capital F, on U, which of course needs to know about this neighboring point with respect to a single point. But it says, OK, I can now see this in this way. The time derivative of U is equal to something that depends on U. And so the method of line is to say, well, if you take that philosophy, now you can use anything you know for integrating the ODEs to exploit this one. And so immediately you just have, you borrow everything, all the techniques from ODEs. And the only burden on you is to say, OK, this is what I'm going to do, this F of U. I'm going to be discretizing this way, et cetera. But again, so this is available for you. And now you have a much larger family of things to deal with, which will give you the options to get more accuracy, et cetera. And the last piece of information I want to say that we didn't include before is this thing that, so invariably, finite difference approximations do really well for low, and this is true for essentially all discretization schemes, regardless, discretization techniques, finite differences, finite elements, spectral methods, etc. They all do an amazing job at low frequencies and an awful job at high frequencies. You don't have enough points to describe some feature that may be there in, with support, say, if these are your points in your grid. I mean, you have a very hard time dealing with that, regardless of the technique. Typically, especially in nonlinear problems, those modes that you're treating the worst in your implementation will be the ones that cause the problem in your simulation, will be the ones that will degrade your accuracy, will make the code go unstable, etc. So Kreis and Oliger in the, I think, 50s, they just said, okay, if going back to the bad joke I made the other day, if something bugs you, kill it if you can. And it's the one where you say, okay, if I have this problem that high frequencies are bugging me, and I'm not doing a good job, I might as well try to make sure that if they are there, they don't work against me. And so for any equation, let me just write this one again, I can say, well, remember, we never iterate this equation. We are iterating an approximation to this equation. So let's change the approximation so that we now control pieces like this. And this, and the simplest possible option is to say, well, let me just do this. So this is going to be delta x. So I now change my equation. I'm adding a piece that is multiplied by delta x, and you could complain very quickly about this, but we'll get to this in a second. I'm adding a piece that is totally dissipative. This is like the same equation we discussed before. This one will introduce an exponential decay of modes, which is going to be faster for the higher frequencies. The delta, so if I, let me just do the Fourier expansion again. So if I think of my solution being described by this, when I plug it in here, I'm going to have S coming from this guy, IK coming from that guy, but from this guy, I'm going to have minus, let me imagine that I also have a parameter there, epsilon, minus epsilon K squared. Which then means that now my solution is e to the I, e to the k, no, I want I k t plus x times e to the minus epsilon k squared t times delta. So this one will grab, will take the highest frequency modes, the one that has the k the largest, and we'll just kill the heck of them, right? It's just as you evolve, they just get dumped down. So you can complain twice about this. So one is to say, well, what if that's the frequency I want? Well, if that's the frequency you want, the ones you're killing, then the argument is you don't have enough resolution because these are, you're just trying to deal with something that is on the highest end of the possible frequency you can accommodate. So what the message is, just use more resolution. You're not in the right regime. Notice that the low frequencies for K lows, you're not modifying, you're not affecting this a lot. When you have a K squared, which is low, that K squared will be a low number. You're multiplying further by delta, so they shouldn't be too affected. So you can always, and also you have this epsilon, you can always adjust it so that it doesn't bug for the amount of time that you're trying to evolve. But the main complaint is to say, well, suppose I work really hard to get a second order approximation to this equation. Now you're telling me that I'm modifying to first order. I change it with the first order. And you're perfectly right. But I can fix it by saying, okay, which order do you want? You want fourth order? Okay, let me put a six here. And then put six derivatives. Again, the message is always the same. You want to modify it such that, A, you don't change the order of the accuracy of the scheme you're putting, but you want to add a dissipative term in that case. So in this case, I'll have something that goes like K to the 6. And it's only going to be dissipating only the very high frequencies and will leave everything else fine. So this numerical dissipation is something that is used in all possible techniques. And they come with different names. In finite differences, numerical dissipation. In spectral approximation, it's used anti-aliasing effects. And they're just fancy names to do, or filtering to do exactly what we just said. And so make sure that if you all of a sudden, and if you go back to the first examples you did, remember when you have this pulse that would go bounce off the boundary, come back, you had this thing that with this very small frequency that was there, you knew it was fake and you didn't worry about it. You were mainly worried about the overall main behavior. If you really wanted to kill those guys, you can just add that and it will be gone. And it's important that you kill them in a nonlinear case, because think of this function which goes, say, from minus 1 to 1 on points. And now think that you have a term like this that goes like u square. All of a sudden, this function that goes from minus 1 to 1 at each sequential point, when you square it, you end up with something that is constant. Right? All of a sudden, something that leaves in the very high frequency came all the way to the low frequency, and it's going to be there, and it's going to bug you. Of course, if you had something that is twice the frequency, then you would. Let me just throw this example, the last one. So let's imagine that these are your points. And you go from here to there, and this from minus 1 to 1. The square of this one in this grid is a constant function given by 1. On the other hand, if your grid wasn't that one, but it was this one, so something that is twice refined, now the square of that one is this one. Right? So in that case, you just see that by having twice as many points, something that was in the high frequencies ends up at even higher frequencies. With having half those points, something that was at the highest frequency, all the way to the zeroth frequency, and it's going to bug your simulation, and you're going to get the wrong result. So that's why you say, okay, typically the highest frequency, given that I'm going to do them wrong anyways, let's just try to control them. Okay, and I'm getting really out of time, or I have negative time now. And the last thing I wanted to say is just a code. So you were given this code, this RMPL. I mean, it's very useful to get something going. I mean, depending on how complicated a situation you may be dealing with, you might have to write your own code. But we discussed the basic ingredients. The rest is just either Fortran, C, or whatever language might be useful for you, wrapper, where you say, okay, I want to define the initial data, I define this way. I have a particular way of advancing with time. You have a do loop or a counter that will take you from all your different slices and so on. But so there is, if you need help, you can always contact me or Franz or Matt. We can give you pointers. We're perfectly happy doing that. But we try to hide that away so that we don't have to worry about this, because that will in itself require its own course. And finally, you had these basic tools, these XVS, DVs, et cetera, which you didn't get to play around much with DV. But if you're interested, I can let you know. Which, again, what we were trying to highlight mainly there is that it's extremely important to have a way to interact with data, especially when we don't know what the solution is. You want to dig out. You might do a simulation. You get the your output. You want to understand where it's accurate, where high frequencies are going, how your simulation is reacting as you go along, et cetera. That's always important. So regardless of whether you use these tools or not, if you're ever going to do a numerical implementation, make sure that you get your hands on something that will let you interact with the data, because it's going to be very important. And with that, let me just stop here. And anything else you might need, you know, when my office is 257, I'll be there. And I'll be here this afternoon for the tutorials as well. Okay. Thank you.